market.
The S&P, the ASX stocks.
This is Motley Fool Money.
Welcome to Motley Fool Money, the podcast that is worth 7% less than it was last week. I'm Scott Phillips, and with me, as always, the doctor is in the house, Dr. Nirban Mahati. How are you, buddy?
Good, how are you?
I'm exceptionally well, thank you, mate. We've just come off the end of a heated conversation, a positive and friendly heated conversation, so there's plenty of energy in the room. We may touch on that later, we may not. In the meantime, mate, 7% down. The podcast, well, the good news for our listeners is the podcast is now 7% cheaper. The bad news is they're paying nothing for it, so it still doesn't cost anything, so maybe that's good news anyway. But of course, the 7% we're talking about is the Australian economy. I was a bit surprised by that. We'll talk about the fact we are now officially because we already knew it, but it's now official. The numbers have been printed. We are in recession. Now, we'll talk about the Australian dollar possibly on its way to 80 cents. Despite all that, AMP is putting itself up for sale. Buy now, pay later. You may have heard of it. Apparently, it's a thing. It's massive in the news again this week, share price and business-wise. And then there's Zoom. Zoom is a company that is making buy now, pay later look pedestrian by comparison. And we will, as always, dip into the full mailbag. That's a full list, mate. Can we get through it in less than an hour, do you reckon?
Oh, let's try.
Let's give it our best shot. We'll see how we go.
Motley Fool Money. For more, go to fool.com.au/MMM.
Mate, we can't start without talking about the big bit of news. The only news really that's mattered this week in the Australian economy, and it's terrible news for a whole lot of people. Officially, we had confirmed what we already had known already. The economy is 7% smaller than it was 3 months earlier. It's the largest fall on record. Now, we should say that quarterly GDP has only been produced since 1959. So just ignore those headlines that kind of, you know, imply that it's the largest fall ever. It's not. It's only the largest fall since we've been recording it. That being said, 60 years is a pretty long track record to break and to have the worst performance ever. So, you know, kind of a big deal. Not worse than the Great Depression, thankfully. And certainly a very different set of scenarios, mate. But it's hard to escape. For every $100 of economic activity 3 months ago, we've now got $93 in the most recently completed quarter.
Yeah, and yet not surprising, right? I mean, if you have a forced shutdown where a lot of things are closed, people are at home, you know, and therefore people's also jobs are at risk or jobs aren't there, you would expect that there's reduced economic activity. I mean, you know, frankly, I would say that, you know, 7% actually is not that bad. I would have thought it could be 8%, could be 10%.
Well, it's actually much better than almost every other developed economy, I think. I mean, we saw Singapore down 40%. I think Sweden was down 8.6%, I saw on Twitter a couple of days ago. Again, like being the least worst isn't anything to brag about. But as you say, and again, I'm not saying we're necessarily better. I'm not saying we're anything, you know, we don't necessarily deserve to be better or worse. We just happen to be. Given the choice, again, we're probably lucky being Australia rather than almost anywhere else around the Western world.
Yeah. So again, like, I mean, there's a number of things here. It all depends on, again, so GDP depends on how, like, it's being calculated. It also depends on what the government is doing, right? Yeah. So the government could, for example, build stuff that actually nobody's going to use ever, right? So it could be effectively non-productive stuff and GDP would go up.
Right.
So I think, you know, like...
And equally, if, you know, for example, if last quarter we'd had a cyclone and there'd been a whole lot of damage repaired, this quarter we didn't have one, GDP in theory would go down even though we're no worse off in any other meaningful sense.
Yeah, or, you know, you could have a flood and storm and whatever last quarter, and this quarter, therefore, relatively speaking, you'd be better off.
Yeah, exactly.
So, you know, like, it's like any other number. I don't pay too much attention. I think what is worth, in my mind, the most important number, it's not a GDP number. Mm. The most important number is really the unemployment numbers and the underemployment numbers.
Yeah.
That is what I think I would watch, because that effectively really translates directly to people, right? The GDP could be whatever. But what, you know, if the government basically gave free money to people and people were not not employed, the unemployment numbers would still stay low
or
very high and the GDP numbers would look just fine.
Yeah,
so,
you
know, are people employed? Are people, you know, therefore happy? Are people going about, you know, utilizing their full potential? Mm-hmm. That's what so, you know, like many other economic headlines, I generally ignore them because economists are, you know, they're good for something, but they're sometimes not good for many things.
Right.
And GDP is one of the things. GDP, actually, in my opinion, is increasingly an irrelevant metric, in my view, largely because, you know, you can do capitalism without capital, and if you can do capitalism without capital, really it does not, the way we measure GDP maybe is not relevant, but that's anyway.
So is it the GDP isn't relevant, or just that the calculation needs to be updated in your mind?
I think the single most important metric is employment. And I think, and the second related metric would be wage increases, right? Because if the wages are relatively stable and going up with an upward trend, I think that shows that your economy is delivering wage growth. And at the same time, if you have most of your people effectively happily employed, I think that is a sign of, in my mind, the most important sign of a healthy economy. Yep. You know, irrespective of, you can have GDP growth at 1%, but if everybody's employed and everybody's getting wage growth, that's fine.
I think that's right. I think obviously, you know, as you say, both the unemployment numbers and the wages numbers, probably that there's some standard of living measure somewhere in all that talks about how well we're all doing, both on average and maybe in some sort of, you know, distributive fashion, to make sure everyone's getting some of the pie, means and medians and all that kind of stuff, modes notwithstanding. I think it makes absolute sense, and I completely agree. Bhutan has gross national happiness, so maybe we should move down that path.
Yeah, like, I mean, you know, you could have happiness, you could have happiness index. I don't know how you'd calculate. You can have a human development index, right? I mean, a lot of these things are intertwined. But I don't know, if I had to look up, you know, one metric, I'd think employment is important, I think, for people. If people, you know, if you have unemployment causes a lot of other problems, right?
Right, it really does. Yeah.
Right, so even if some people are unemployed and getting money, it could have psychological issues, right?
Mental health
issues, right?
Absolutely.
How do you capture that? You don't capture that in the GDP metric, right? So indirectly, you're capturing via the unemployment metric, right? So I really think that's the important number. I'd like that to, you know, steadily go down.
And a lot of it's mentioned house prices too, but there's something, I mean, you know, again, mortgage stress, for example, people who have houses in theory have some degree of wealth in air quotes, but again, the more of our mortgage or the more of our salary that goes towards paying off the mortgage, for example, another part of, you know, are we genuinely well off, or are we on this sort of, you know, depressing treadmill? There's all those things really to take into account, right?
That's right, right. Yeah, so like, I mean, the whole, you know, you might have home equity and you might have home debt, and then if you have mortgage, you land up spending, you know, whatever, 30% of your income in mortgage. That's going into one sector, not in the other sector. So, but again, relatively speaking, if people were employed and they were paying their mortgages, how they're choosing to spend is a different question. I think that's a secondary question in my mind, people are choosing to spend, right? Somebody could choose to spend 40% of their income on mortgage. Somebody might decide to spend 20, right? They might go and buy something else for the remainder that they've got left. So that's a personal choice. But I think if you have the income, then you have those choices that you can make. But if you know, that's an income can come from the government for free, right? Support, or the income can come because you've earned. That has a different meaning, you know. I think, again, it's difficult to quantify that in numbers. But, you know, your happiness index or, you know, mental health index or whatever you want to talk about. So I think that's the most important thing. I'd like that number, the unemployment numbers, to actually start going down. That would make me happy.
Now, speaking of that, then let's look forward from GDP, because I saw some numbers from a mob called Capital Economics. I haven't looked at the methodology and I don't know their track record, but they're actually suggesting that, remember, of course, the numbers we just saw during the week were actually numbers for the June quarter, which finished 62 days ago. We're literally more than two-thirds of the way through the next quarter before the last one's released. And Capital Economics, at least, and again, I don't have any view on their success or otherwise, but they actually believe the September quarter will be positive. So in fact, by the very barest of metrics, it's entirely possible we're two-thirds away out of recession and don't yet know it. We won't know until December 2 whether that's true. But I mean, you know, to the extent we're talking about being in recession now, if the September quarter is positive by even the smallest margin, we'd be officially out of recession, and maybe we already are by now as we talk about this horrible number. Also a reminder, I think, that, you know, the numbers are useful to some degree. They do tell us where we have been. They give us some sense of, you know, the most up-to-date data you can find, but it's entirely possible things are already on the improve.
Yeah, that is definitely possible. I mean, again, this is hard to tell, right? I mean, you'd only know it post facto once the information is out there. Again, like as I said, I don't pay too much attention to that GDP number. What I really, as I said, I pay more attention to the employment number. So if the unemployment numbers start improving significantly, I think that would be positive. So one way to think about that is there's been job creation in New South Wales, basically rest of Australia except for Victoria, right? So that, that is a net positive. Yeah. Yeah. On the other hand, Victoria's had job losses. So I don't know how much is being compensated for.
It is the problem with unemployment too, and I think that's why it's important, because recessions last for one or two quarters, but it normally takes a couple of years for unemployment to actually get back to pre-recession levels. So as much as the headlines tell one story, you're absolutely right to say, well, that's something. But we have to, it's worth just thinking a little bit further about, it will take a long time for this pain to be unwound for a whole lot of people. While we've kind of moved on, in air quotes, the headlines will change and economic growth will be positive and we'll say the recession's over and people all want to celebrate, but there are longer issues than just that.
Yeah, so just to one final point, right? You could have, say, 3-4 quarters of really, down.
Mm-hmm.
Once you've hit enough down, eventually it'll go up.
Exactly.
Right? And then headlines will change from,
go from 180 and then back to 81 doesn't exactly say you're rich.
Yeah, exactly.
Does it?
Which is why I said the absolute metric, which is the people employed, is the really useful metric.
Yeah.
And and I think we want to pay attention to that. I don't have a view of how that is going to, shake out. It looks to me, it appears, at least the New South Wales, for example, is doing better than what maybe people would have expected on the job front. So there are lots of unanswered
questions. I got to say, and I was so, again, let's not dwell too much on GDP, but I have to say I was kind of surprised it was that bad. The a lot of the forecasts were 5 to 7% from people who should know this stuff, economists. Retail sales was positive last set of numbers, and we're recording this on Thursday, the 3rd of September. Tomorrow, retail sales are due out again, and the tip is they're going to be positive again. Jobs are being created. To your point, I got to say I was a little bit surprised. I kind of thought that with probably positive job creation, probably positive retail sales, I didn't think we'd be positive. We knew we were in recession, but I thought we'd do better than 7, I have to say. And I don't know if there's maybe it's to your point, a calculation or a measurement question. Certainly we know household spending was 20% of income, which is just, we never have those numbers, right? Such is the dislocation. If it goes from 6 to 8, everyone does cartwheels, went from, I don't remember, 6 or 7 to 20%. These are some screwy, screwy numbers. But to some degree, hopefully at least, we're on the path forward. Do we dare hope that we're already starting to improve?
I don't know. As I said, again, I think if you have multiple quarters of bad things, then eventually things will at some point improve. So we are 2 quarters down. Maybe we're already on the mend. It's again hard to say, but
you can only hope.
You can only hope, and you can just watch for the numbers and see what happens.
Now, mate, how is it possible that we have a massive recession, and yet the Australian dollar seems to be absolutely, the most weightless thing in the world? There's gravity everywhere except for the Australian dollar. Normally, a bad economy, a tough economy. Frankly, when we went to the GFC, the dollar fell, I want to say, 55 cents. The Australian dollar's going the opposite direction. Not that long ago, it was under 70, and then it was 72 for a while, hitting 74 and a half recently. And some people, again, those same economists who thought it was going to get a 60, now think it's going to get to 80. So maybe we should take that with a grain of salt. But a recession, but the Australian dollar is going to 80 cents. I guess, how, why, and what does it mean for investors?
Again, this is one of those things that's really hard to pinpoint exactly the what's and the how's and the why's. There's so many factors here.
Yeah.
So commodity exports have been doing really well, right? Mm-hmm. So that's number one. And the number two thing I would say is there's easing everywhere.
Mm.
But I think probably the biggest change, we're talking about the Aussie relative to the USD, right? So the big change is the Fed policy, where the Fed policy is basically saying that they're going to target long-term average inflation. What basically that means is, instead of looking forward, in the past they would have this dot plots of, I guess, where they think the interest rate should be for a given inflation number.
Yeah.
What they're now saying is that on average over some period of time, we want to hit this 2% or whatever that they want to hit, right?
Yeah.
What that basically means is that you could actually have inflation at 4% and have the interest rate still at 0.
Yeah.
Or effectively 0.
Right, exactly.
So the change with this policy effectively means is it's basically a telegraph to the market that the interest rates, the Fed interest rates, US Fed interest rates are effectively going to stay where they are for a really long time. This is net negative for Australia in a way, right?
Okay, tell me how.
Because, well, I mean, you know, if you're an export economy, you want the dollar actually to be relatively lower, right? So the you know, the RBA governor would have been happier for the dollar to be at 70 cents than at 80 cents. It just makes his job harder. In fact, I've seen some speculation now in the media or in sort of the economic circles or those people who make these forecasts that, you know, maybe we will see negative interest rates to counter the 80 cents. So I think that's the dynamic. I think the major driver here is the USD, not anything, you know, and maybe the secondary driver is the demand for commodities, but that would be my interpretation.
Yeah, no, I think you did right, actually, mate. That's certainly the accepted wisdom, and maybe we should be mindful of worried about that. But yeah, the weak US dollar in particular, a key one, the strong demand for commodities. Interestingly enough, too, and we won't get too macro here because it's just probably more theoretical interest than something we actually can do for our listeners. But we've seen the iron ore price continue to stay strong as demand stayed high. And yet the oil price has gone the opposite direction as people worry about oil's kind of impact when it comes to economic growth. And I was a little surprised, I have to say. Like, yeah, there are reasons why one might move one direction, one over the other in kind of esoteric theoretical terms. But generally speaking, with the economy around the world in such terrible shape, the iron ore price is holding up remarkably well. Demand holding up pretty well, mostly out of China, despite all this stuff. And again, you know, that says something about maybe, you know, those who are buying iron ore and using it for some sort of productive use in theory, and yet it's not supposed to give the commodity traders a right flow through to actual broad economic activity. It feels like a bit of a disconnect to me. Am I reading it wrong?
So I have a theory about that.
Ah, good. Okay.
You know, again, there's no basis for this theory. But my theory
not
really
one
is
either, don't worry.
My theory really is that I think, you know, everybody loves, you know, as I said, I dislike the GDP numbers because GDP numbers are gamed quite a bit. You can can game a lot of things. GDP is the easiest one probably to game for a government.
Right.
And one way to show growth in China is to just do construction, even if it is meaningless construction. And the construction requires iron ore. And I think that's part of the driver in my mind for the commodity, right? So
should at least mean though there's economic activity coming from that. You can't have construction without economic activity. The two, even if it is game, should be linked to some degree, right?
Well, so there's economic activity of construction happening, mandated by government.
Right.
Right.
But that does, even if it is mandated, even if it is kind of, you know, a bit like JobKeeper, JobSeeker, if it's artificial, it is actually putting money into the economy. It's, you know, those people are working, the people are buying and selling things.
Absolutely. I'm not disagreeing with that. What I'm saying is that if it is an elevated level of demand, that elevated level of demand is not a normal demand, then you would at some point expect normal demand to settle in.
Yeah,
right. Which would mean that the commodity prices would at that point, you know, again, this is a question of what the cycle looks like.
Yeah.
Commodity prices at that point are going to fall.
Right.
Because we have returned to sort of a normal demand level.
Okay, so, that's what you're saying.
Yeah, so that's my theory about what's going on because I cannot pinpoint any other reason for demand for commodity other than forced demand creation, right? I mean, given the type of situation we have, we wouldn't expect construction activity to be driving, iron ore, for example. Mm-hmm. So that's interpretation for that. Rest of the stuff, again, I don't follow it very closely, but that's my theory.
I like it. Let's get to it company specific, mate. Stay tuned.
Motley Fool Money. Financial advice for real people, not trust fund hippies. Sign up for the newsletter at fool.com.au/MMM.
Poor old AMP, Doc. Now, you didn't grow up in Australia. I did, and in my early years, AMP was the, I'm going to say only, national financial name of any significance that actually mattered to people. It's one of those companies, one of only two that I can really recall where back in the good old days, mate, and this is a bit of Australia kind of maturing, I think, as a country. We had two national businesses that were known by everybody. So well known were they. They actually were kind of named in the abstract. So BHP back in the day was called the BHP. You didn't work at BHP, you worked at the BHP, right? It was one of those things, not that it mattered either, but just the fact you put the in front of it is almost kind of that sense of it's not just a company, right? It's the BHP. It's always like, you know, it's the something is a big deal. The AMP was the other one. People worked at the AMP. You got your life insurance from the AMP. Now, of course, we've changed the terminology now. Now it's just BHP and AMP, and that's just, again, one of those things. Maybe I'm making too big a deal of it, but in 19, you know, I've used the example at airlines before. If someone had said to you that airline travel was going to go through the roof, you would have bought every airline you could and lost a fortune, or I would have. The same is true of AMP. If you'd have been able to forecast accurately what the financial services industry would look like in 2020 for all of its warts and all of its some good, mostly, maybe mostly bad, we'll hold that over, mostly bad fees anyway. And you said, look, AMP is the national, you would have put a small fortune on AMP being phenomenally larger today than in 1975 or 1980. The business that should have absolutely been able to say, hey, this is massive great wave, all I have to do is, I don't even have to catch the wave, I just have to stay there and let the wave push me. They had to do nothing. You think about the combined market caps of Westpac, Commonwealth Bank, some of the fund managers, you kind of roll the financial industry together and say, look how big this has become. And poor old bloody AMP is, if not down over the last decade, treading water at best. This has been one of those snatching defeat from the jaws of victory kind of jobs. And now the ultimate indignity, the incoming chairwoman, Deborah Hazelton, has effectively said, everything's for sale. Everything's, you know, it's the garage sale where you open the front door, you put a price on everything and say, here's the price. If you guys want it, I guess you can have it. They're bringing in external advisors. They're saying, guys, come and tell us what we should do with all of our entire business, literally, either as a whole or piece by piece, is now available for sale. Whether they actually sell it or not, different question. But man, how the mighty have fallen. This is just, again, I can't quite impress you. There may have been examples in India or Canada or US we've been. But I can't impress on you how much of a institution the AMP was. And to see it, you know, go so terribly is almost, you know, I don't want to wax too lyrical here, but it does feel like kind of a, you know, something of a betrayal of kind of what it should or could have been by so many generations of managers who have just completely screwed this thing up.
Yeah, every good thing comes to an end, sort of thing. So,
not Apple.
It's not 200 years old or whatever.
That's true.
AMP is what, like 100 years old or something?
The Australian Mutual Providence Society was what AMP stands for, if you can believe that.
Yeah. So, 100 years of life for a corporation is a long life.
Yes.
And in that you have, you know, you're born, you have growth, mm-hmm. you have, steady, I guess, middle age, and then you have decline. This is the cycle.
Oh, you're a hero of the company. Just be gentle. Well, just be gentle.
I'm just talking about, but this is true for, this sort of thing has happened to General Electric,
yeah,
right?
Yeah.
I mean.
Yeah, right.
So it's not uncommon. Doesn't surprise me. You know, at some point what happens is the company just loses focus, is not able to change with changing times. It's not able to keep pace. And stuff happens, and then your blue chip becomes the sort of the, you know,
yeah,
you know, you're on debt watch. So
yeah,
not surprising. It's been as you said, a decade of horrible share price performance.
Oh man, and it's funny actually. It's a good point. I wonder, like, you're a growth investor anyway. I don't imagine you've ever looked at AMP more than for 5 seconds when we talked about it this morning. But there is something to the, you know, the life cycle of businesses. I worked for a company who I won't name because I don't want to, you know. There's some decent people trying their best, but the only word I could use to describe that business was calcified, literally to the point of, so I may have mentioned in the past, so maybe people put dots together, but when I got there 10 years ago, I said, not super recently, but close enough, they were still using Lotus Notes as their email provider. I had to specifically ask to use Microsoft Excel rather than Lotus as my software, because I was doing some work on that. The suggestions when I made some as a new employee of, hey, we should do X, were either, no, we don't do that here, or we've tried that before, it doesn't work. And it was just the culture of the organization was just incredibly, incredibly calcified. It wasn't a great industry, to be fair. It wasn't a business that was ever going to have hyper growth. But just that sense of, it almost felt like what you imagine a staid kind of government department to look like, you know, rather than a commercial enterprise that was profit making. It was listed, by the way, at the time. Just a really, really tough business. And I guess that does happen. You know, if you don't stay nimble, you can calcify really quickly.
That's correct. And I think, again, that happens with, you know, as our organizations mature, it's really hard to be, you know, I can't really think of a very old organization that is like nimble. Like when I say, you know, even organization that's been around for like 50 years and is still nimble. Like, I mean, you know, the software companies you're talking about or tech companies you're talking about, most of them have been born in the 70s or the 80s. Right? So they're still not there.
They're old, but not quite the kind of geriatric stage just yet.
Yeah, IBM is a good example. Like, IBM has been
Hewlett Packard maybe too.
Hewlett Packard, IBM. Well, Hewlett Packard is now sold or decomposed into two pieces.
Correct.
So
a bit like maybe AMP, right?
Yeah. Well, they have two companies that were split into two companies.
Yeah, yeah.
So at least those two companies are around. But yeah, like, you know, Hewlett Packard IBM are the two that come to my mind.
It's a tough one. I don't hold out much hope for AMP. It's possible even that we lose the brand as the businesses get sold off into their parts, and particularly if they're bought by other trade buyers who want to roll the funds management business together. And it's a decent question, right? After so many scandals, after so long being irrelevant to many people, other than people who grew up with the name, it's you do wonder actually what the brand actually stands for, right? Not much good. It's conflicted financial advice. The company got given grief at the Royal Commission. The company that should have, could have, would have, didn't. At some point, the brand, I'm not sure if it's a net negative, but not worth a whole lot anymore.
Yeah, I think that's correct. Ken, stuff like that happens, but hopefully it's a small portion for people's portfolios. Well, it would, if you had a decent position in it, it would have become a small position. But Ken, it's a good reminder.
It is a good reminder. Is it a good reminder? Speaking of things becoming going from large to small, so it's something going from small to large, mate. Buy now, pay later. To afterpay something has almost become a verb, like to Google something. The BNPL acronym is known by almost everybody these days. Anyone who reads the financial press anyway, such is its prevalence, such is its share price gain. It's deserving of mention just because of the sheer, I was going to say gains, certainly gains up until this week, and a bit of falls this week so far. So volatility maybe rather than just pure gains. It's been all over the place, mate. Afterpay knocked on the door of $100. I don't know if I actually ever got there. You watch it more closely than I did. Maybe it did for a short time. Zip, Sezzle, OpenPay, Splitit. It's all anyone wants to talk about right now. So I guess we should because people are asking about it. We certainly we had a Motley Fool Platinum event actually last night. So we recorded, as I said, on Thursday, the 3rd of September. And that was a really super popular conversation as well. The whole sector, mate, is fascinating. I am on record as saying Afterpay, like probably Fortescue before it, maybe CSL before that, one of the rare Australian businesses that goes on to genuinely have an innovative product that is upsetting the global apple cart in a meaningful way, right? You think about the Fortescue building an iron ore business from literally nothing and becoming one of the biggest four iron ore providers. Afterpay being, I think, the only company I can think of in the modern era to genuinely challenge the, maybe since PayPal, the kind of payment dominance of the big guys between the FPOS networks and the credit card companies. It's taken a whole lot of people with it. It's trying to get into the US. I'm not sure what the question is, other than what do you make of the last couple of weeks of action in the buy now, pay later space?
Well, a lot has been happening in the buy now, pay later space. So a couple of things. So I think they had really good results, or at least great customer growth, retail, availability growth in terms of where Afterpay is accepted. The underlying sales volumes have gone up, like more than 100%.
Phenomenal.
So phenomenal. The interesting news yesterday, the day before, was that PayPal, which you just mentioned, has launched its own buy now, pay later.
Yeah, that is fascinating. That's
fascinating. That's fascinating to me in a couple of different ways. One is it almost legitimizes the fact that buy now, pay later is here. Makes me feel that PayPal thought that if we don't get into this, we can become irrelevant.
Yeah.
Right? And I think PayPal is an interesting example because for whatever you think about PayPal is not the same thing as a Visa or a MasterCard, right? So PayPal doesn't own the network. It's a payment methodology, platform for enable payments and exchange of payments and things like that. It's a lot more like Tyro, for example, than like Visa or MasterCard, right? So if you're a company like that and you could become potentially relevant because customers don't want to merchants don't want to use you because guess what? There's another way of doing it.
And
then you can become irrelevant. Yeah, and if that's the case, you need to compete. That is very interesting to me in my mind. And there are a gazillion players in this buy now, pay later sector. So now that you have a gorilla enter, it's going to be very interesting because there's a gorilla and then there's like the thought leader.
Yep.
And you know, maybe it's a duopoly. Mm-hmm. And the question in my mind is, you know, what is, how is this fight going to evolve and shape up over time? Certainly, PayPal has the balance sheet and the profits and the cash flow to actually have buy now, pay later as a loss leader product just to grow it. So that's the interesting thing in my mind. Valuation is really, this sort of thing is, valuation is really hard. I mean, you know, if buy now, pay later could replace, in theory, all of PayPal, then, you know, PayPal's, you know, there's a lot more room to run, right? So that's another way to think about the, you know, you think about like a $20 billion company and compare that, I don't know how much PayPal is, but PayPal probably easily is around 200 billion or something like that,
right.
150 billion, I would guess. Let me have a look.
See, yeah,
250 billion.
Oh, there you go. Well done.
So, say if you compare, and that's US, right?
Yep.
So compare PayPal with Afterpay. Afterpay is really going after PayPal.
Yeah.
That is potentially like a 10 bagger or more, 15 bagger if you think about the exchange rate, right?
Yep.
So, I think this is really interesting. It validates Afterpay. At the same time, it raises the risk. It raises the risk for all the other competing forces.
Yeah.
It raises regulatory risk as well.
Yeah. I completely agree. I think that it does exactly both of those things, right? I have been convinced for a very long time, not very long time, months. It feels like a long time in this coronavirus world. I've been convinced that splitting of payments becomes the future. Because it's provided by one person and it's desired by customers and the competitors have to respond. I'm not surprised to see Afterpay respond. I don't know the end game here, mate. I've got to say, if you play this all the way out, I can imagine a scenario where every bank and every credit card company simply offers something similar as a matter of course to be relevant. You know, that at some future point, you know, 99% of our purchases are effectively deferred over multiple weeks. Now, bottom line, by the way, makes no difference, right? Because the total amount of money we spend, we're just kind of putting all of us on kind of 1 month overdrafts for all of our spending, maybe except for mortgages. But maybe the ATO doesn't like overdraft spending either. Let's find out. But at some point, you know, if it becomes common practice, does that, I mean, on one hand, that does absolutely say, well, hey, Afterpay is the leader. It gives it more room to run. It legitimizes it. It makes it more likely. On the other hand, by the time X number of competitors offer it, then, you know, if PayPal uses it, then Commonwealth Bank might offer it, then Amex might offer it, and then, I don't know, Apple Pay might offer it, just to pick four, and not pick Apple Pay in particular, or, you know, it's just they should or shouldn't, or they are, or they're not going to. But at some point, you know, a bit like, you know, Kleenex became Australian for tissue, in a way that actually then eroded the brand value, or everything's a Band-Aid, not the Band-Aid brand. You know, if you look at 5 years, if you know, more than X percent of our business is being done in some sort of standard deferred payment by multiple providers, does Afterpay have enough reason for being left? Do merchants start saying, well, hang on, I'm not going to pay you X percent if I can get it from everybody else in the market. I'm going to say to my customers, look, dude, you can use your Commonwealth Bank FOS account and do the same thing and I don't have to pay the bill or whatever. Does that at some point threaten Afterpay's model, or is it got enough brand equity and kind of lead to keep winning that race?
So that's the hard question. I think, like, how much can the how much can you actually get in terms of, like, you know, the transaction price from the merchant, right? That's the question, and how much squeeze there's going to be. I think there's going to be a margin squeeze over time, but as the margin decreases on that, you'd think the volume also increases.
Yeah, great.
So the volume goes up. If you think of all the transactions that happen today that don't go through BPNL and actually eventually go through BPNL, you could actually have like 1.5% as the fee.
Yeah, right.
Okay. And that'll be fine.
Yep. Makes sense. I think that's right. I have no view on that, by the way. I've literally got no view as to how that plays out, but it's certainly going to be a fascinating one to watch. Speaking of which, Parliament last night, so again, we're recording this on Thursday, last night released a report saying basically they were happy with the way buy now, pay later was regulated and that they felt that was reasonable to give Afterpay and its ilk a bit of a free kick. But at some point, the regulator should be responsible for deciding when those rules should change. That they didn't want to stifle innovation. I know that's something you've talked about before, so they're on your page. But they did also kind of leave the door open a little bit to kind of invite the regulator to recommend regulation. You mentioned PayPal and the possibility of regulation there. You and I have long said, or we've said in the past, mate, unless your views change, that I personally I won't put these words in your mouth. I'll put them in mine, then I'll bring you in. I absolutely think these guys should be regulated because they're a debt provider. Any debt provider should be regulated, to my view, not give it a free pass because there's no official interest in air quotes being charged. So I think they should be regulated. But you and I have agreed in the past that such regulation would actually benefit the incumbents because it would make them more legitimate. It would give them their competitors a higher bar to clear and kind of bring them in with the big boys in a way that, you know, yes, they might chafe at the regulation, but as the incumbent, we've seen, you know, Facebook and others say, yeah, we want more regulation, which is partly a recognition of the zeitgeist and partly a recognition that the more they can help set the rules and be subject to them, the harder it is for other players to kind of pop up and meet the same regulatory requirements.
Yeah, I think that's true. I mean, the problem with regulation is the people making the regulation often have no clue of what they're regulating, right? I mean, in general, right? And the reason behind that is regulation is often backward-looking, right? It looks at what is going on today and tries to regulate that. Mm. The net effect of that often regulation is the regulation actually stifles innovation.
Yeah.
So I'm not a big fan of regulation as such, but as you said, like, I mean, you know, if it's a credit product of some form, then you regulate it at least in some way. And if you regulate it, it basically helps, again, the leaders. So, I mean, you have to balance the needs of customers, the needs of innovation, and therefore the intervention. You know, I'm not a big fan of regulators as such. Mm. But yeah, there's probably a nice middle ground here. Mm. But I think I agree with you that if there is regulation, a heavy-handed regulation of some form, it actually only helps the incumbents, which, you know, in a strange way might actually help Afterpay.
You'd think so, and it certainly gives them a more stable footing to start from. And frankly, also makes any other potential competitors, either bank or otherwise, by the way, come up with a better, you know, a new way. And we talked about calcified old businesses. Changing the game has already worked for them to some degree. If you can lock them in with regulation, it makes it harder again. But we shall see. We shall see. Mate, speaking of companies doing well, this is so we have a group of people in the US, in our sister company in the US, who also do a podcast. And I heard Chris Hill and Jim Gillies talking about this. Bill Barker and Chris Hill talking about the Zoom results. And they were saying, if this doesn't, this Zoom quarterly number doesn't put it on the Mount Rushmore of all quarterly results ever from large US companies, it would be a phenomenal surprise. Zoom managed to grow revenue at 340% after growing 100% the previous period. So it doubled and then quadrupled effectively. Let's not draw too fine a point on it. That in itself is phenomenal for a business already doing billions of dollars. Its shares shot up in a single day 40%. This is no fly-by-night new tech. I mean, it's new tech at business, but it was already bloody expensive. It's already 10 bagged since the IPO of a couple of years ago. What a phenomenal, phenomenal quarter from Zoom.
Yeah, like, you know, I tweeted about it, and one of the things that I mentioned is if you just look at the free cash flow as a fraction of, as a percentage of revenue, your mouth just opens, and I don't know when, how it closes. It was 56% or something like that, you know. So converting 56% of your revenue to free cash flow, that is just unbelievable. Mm. As a result, you'd expect that, you know, basically a digital business, they should be able to convert after, you know, fixed costs relative, right? Mm. As they scale, they should be having a lot more dollars,
right.
You know, convert to free cash flow.
And I swear to God, how hard can it be to take money to let people just talk over the internet infrastructure that's already there? I mean, I'm simplifying dramatically, but you can kind of imagine how, I mean, it's done no marketing because everyone knows Zoom. People are signing up at a rate of knots because they're throwing money at the company. I mean, to your point, the numbers are phenomenal. By the same token, they kind of should be, right? But equally, that's money being made by shareholders.
Yeah, like, I mean, again, like, it looks, you know, relatively expensive. I forgot what the trailing revenue numbers were. But
they're off,
you know,
zeros on the...
yeah, but the trailing numbers were probably around, you know, 3-4 billion or something like that might be the trailing revenue. Uh-huh. You know, so this must be on some gazillion times multiple. Like, look, again, I've looked at this business a number of times, and I, you know, as a user of the product, I like the product, and I said pass.
Yeah.
But I don't know, like, I mean, if you are the leader and you are, you know, people are buying your stuff because that's what people do.
Mm.
you basically are winning, right? I mean, it's the same thing as it's huge, because it's the same thing as saying, you know, what is the difference between Zoom and Google search? Mm. At a very high level, zero.
Yeah, right.
Right? Because...
Not the company.
Well, at a very high level, there's no difference between the Google search and any other search algorithm. Mm. Google search is just more valuable because, mm-hmm. you know, you have a little bit more data, a little more people coming to it. Google is the way people...
Slightly better quality, better brand recognition. It's a verb itself.
Yeah, you just go there because you do go there. Yeah, but that has happened over time,
yeah,
right?
Yeah.
But at you know, in the early years, there was no reason to believe, at least in my mind, that, you know, it's the algorithm. Somebody else could come up with the same algorithm or some modified version of that algorithm that is very similar, you know, have the same infrastructure, right? So it's, some of these things are, I think there's a big, huge luck factor in many things, right? Mm. You might have a very good product, but it getting brand recognition is something. Mm. Right, and once it gets brand recognition, becomes sort of the verb that everybody talks about. You know, you're just Zooming these days, right? You're not making a video call. You're Zooming. That is huge recall value. All of a sudden, you don't need to do money marketing
to
get people in.
Yeah.
And then once you're Zooming and Zooming works, why would you go to something else?
Yeah, for sure.
Right? And the something else for you to go has to be substantially cheaper for you to actually make it. And you wouldn't have know what that something else is, right? Because people are Zooming.
Yes,
so.
Right.
So I think that's the, you know, and when you're in that situation and you're that profitable a company, you know, maybe the multiple is not that bad. So that's how I look at it. I still don't own shares. You know, my theory with these things is that, you know, you can't have every winner in your portfolio and you wouldn't have every winner in your portfolio.
Yeah.
And it's okay sometimes to say pass as long as you keep your winners and you hold on to them.
Yeah.
That's fine. So that's, you know, but I think it's a phenomenal business. There are very few businesses of this caliber generating that kind of free cash flow. It deserves the multiple. I mean, and
the difference I will throw at you with Zoom, mate, just for fun, just for the conversation. I think it's real, but maybe it's not a big enough deal, is I don't pay for Google. And someone else pays for Google. The search, you know, the search finders pay for Google. The network effect works because more people are there, which makes my search more valuable, makes my search more likely to be right, all the stuff that goes with that. If you started, you know, doc video messaging tomorrow and it was as good, but it was cheaper or free, I think there's not necessarily a reason to switch per se, but no reason to stay with Zoom. That Zoom doesn't offer me as a user anything that an equivalent. If you said to me tomorrow, hey, the Motley Fool's moving to doc video, I'd be like, okay, does it work as well as Zoom? Yeah, it's fine. Okay, cool, I'll change. There's no tie at all for me to stay with Zoom, particularly if I've got a corporate account and I'm paying for it, other than, you know, maybe no one got fired for buying IBM, so maybe no one gets fired for using Zoom at the office these days because everyone does. But to the extent Zoom becomes its own, a bit like Afterpay, its own adjective, its own verb, its own kind of, you know, let's Zoom it. Let's Zoom on doc video. You know, might will be the next passphrase. Maybe I'm bitter because I missed the gains. I'm not sure, but the reason I never bought it is because I've never really understood why it has any sort of competitive advantage whatsoever when it comes to keeping customers against an alternative product. It does. It just feels to me like it's great. It's fantastic. We use it. I like it. It's wonderful. There's no reason for me to change necessarily. But if we did tomorrow, or someone invited me to a call on doc video tomorrow, I would say, no, let's use Zoom. I'd rather use that, please. I'm like, yeah, sure. If it works, let's do it. I don't see why it has any lock at all on any of its revenue moving forward. And I find that's why I find it hard to pay any price for it, because I just simply don't know which competitor pops up next year, the year after, this year, who's already out there, who's about to steal Zoom's lunch. If Microsoft makes their Teams product completely free and I've got to pay for Zoom or something different, it feels like something that's just so ripe for disruption. As much as it's been the disruptor, I just see no stickiness at all in terms of what is defenses against a potential competitor for cheaper, for free, just because it's different, all the same to me.
Yeah, so I think those are all great points. So here's some counter arguments to that. So number one, I think the basic assumption you're making is that it is relatively easy to do a good video product, right? That somebody else can do a relatively good video product.
I'm not saying it's easy necessarily. The odds are pretty high, I think, that among everybody in tech right now, somebody's working on a product that could be at least be the equal, if not better, just almost by definition. And I don't think there's any secret sauce Zoom has that it can always maintain against the march of technology. You know, to imagine it always might be the best video software, I think takes a decent leap of faith because there's nothing kind of lock-in about it. But again, you would know better than me, so tell me why I'm wrong.
So here's one way to think of the state-of-the-art before Zoom, right? I mean, you have Skype, kind of crappy, relative to Zoom. So why is Skype not as good, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, there's an element of product build. There's an element of some underlying technology. I've heard that they have got some very good implementations of the video codec that they're actually using for. So, I mean, again, is that a lead that somebody can't break? I'm sure somebody can. But here's the thing, right? I always ask this question, who can disrupt, at this point, in my mind, a small startup, a video-only company, is unlikely to be that. Like, I mean, we use Slack in our company, right? Yep. But we don't use Slack's video.
Correct.
Right?
Correct.
We use Zoom.
Yeah.
Why? Because Slack's video is just not as good as Zoom.
Also, Zoom, to some degree, it just has different functionality. Like you can invite other people externally more easily.
Right.
Bring someone to a Slack call in your organization is harder. But yeah, you're right. That's absolutely true.
So that's the thing, right? So, I mean, it is not that easy in that sense. Number two, that is Teams, I think, is definitely a competing product, equally good. I think here's the problem. For a typical large company like Microsoft, do you really think that they're interested in, you know, in furthering Teams versus furthering, say, Azure, right? They have bigger fish to fry. Every company.
Totally.
So, like, it is, I think, the companies that can replace and create a product.
Yeah.
Apple could create one tomorrow if it wanted to.
Totally.
Microsoft has a product.
Yep.
Just doesn't have the bandwidth to sell it because, you know, they have so many other things. Every company chooses what they want to do, right?
For sure.
And the bigger the company, the bigger the movement needs to be. You know, for like an app, a couple of $1 billion is nothing. Like, I mean, you know, do I really need those couple of billion? Do I have to put like R&D for that? No, I need something that's going to give me tens of billions and tens of billions relatively quickly, right? So that's the thing. The way I understand Microsoft is going around this is they're basically bundling it as a part of their, you know, 365 package. They're trying to do, you know, this part of the Exchange. They're trying to sell this in package format with their Slack competitor, which is basically Teams. It is just not clean. It's not a clean video product in that sense, right? So, you know, it looks to me there's going to be two competitors, and Google, you know, tries to get into consumer products and always a horrible failure. It's got something. It's constantly pushing people into this Google Meet thing, right? So I think the reality is that the people who can compete are not focused, and the people who could have competed, I think they have been left behind. It's basically the valley, you know, the point at which the transformation happens has happened for, you know, basically Zoom is now self-sustaining in many ways, right? It's profitable, it's generating cash flow, it doesn't need advertisement, it can... This doesn't mean that this is going to continue forever.
Correct. Yeah.
This is going to continue, but it can continue for a long time.
Oh, absolutely can. Right? Yeah, for sure.
Right. So it can continue for the next 5 years.
Yeah.
And maybe next 5 years they do improve their product substantially. So you're making the assumption that they're going to be standstill, right?
Yeah.
If, you know, they could improve their product substantially to become an even better product and therefore stay in the race and stay ahead.
Yeah, very
so
true.
That's those are the things. I mean, it's exactly those reasons, you know, what's the moat, right? I think there are. Fundamentally, now I've come up to a view that this question, asking the what is the moat, will almost always mean that you don't invest in any company that is building a moat, right? Which would almost always mean that you'd miss all the early stage companies because they do not have a moat, right? Because those are the disruptive companies that are going to disrupt. And as I like to say, in today's climate, there are like four companies that can do anything, but even they can't do anything because they have to choose. Because at their scale, they just can't be doing everything.
I'm gonna again not just disagree with you, but just to pass that a little bit. I completely agree with your point about innovative companies don't have moats by definition because they're building businesses. Like, I think that's absolutely true. There are businesses though that you can imagine are building into moats because of the nature of their business models. And I'm still maybe Zoom never has one. Maybe it never needs one because it just stays ahead. Maybe just staying ahead is its own moat, right? But at some point. You know, you could maybe this is hindsight bias, right? But if you pick businesses that are building, so MongoDB, business you like, database company in the US, building an entirely different style of database, and it's doing so in a way that, because of the network infrastructure, is its own moat, right? You either like it or you don't. So they're better mousetrap or it's not. There's stuff that's protected by IP law. There are reasons why it can build a business that if it's successful, has it got a moat yet? No. Could it build? Is it building towards a mode? I think pretty much. Yeah. Now I have no view on whether it will succeed or not. You just because I don't know the tech. You know the tech much better than I do. I accept your version of it. By the way, I'm just saying from me, I can make no independent assessment because I don't know. But in Zoom's case, I don't even see it building towards a mode. To me, it makes it a much lower quality business because of that lack of defensiveness built into it. As it grows, you know, business grow into Google had no moat until it did, but you can kind of imagine how a network effect might grow. Facebook versus MySpace, same thing. You get to a certain scale, you know, MySpace never got there. So, but you could see where you know, can make an argument to buy MySpace even if you were wrong. So, look, more and more people, more network effect. MySpace could be huge. It wasn't at the end, but I can imagine doing that and getting it wrong. Zoom, I still just can't work out. You know, what the defensiveness of its business might. Again, maybe someone's working on something, as you say, deep in the bowels of Zoom headquarters to make it that way. But I just can't for the, you know, you want to see a business building into a mode, I thought, at least that would be the upper echelon of the businesses that you buy, right? The ones that are Zoom plus a mode or you know, Zoom and digging a mode as they go. This one doesn't seem to be doing that.
Yeah, so look, I'm not disagreeing with you. I personally, as I said, don't own the stock, right? I don't, I'm not a holder, I'm not bought, I don't plan to buy.
Yeah, yeah.
And I, as you just mentioned, MongoDB, I do own MongoDB. Mm-hmm. And for some of those reasons, my view with software really at a very high level is a simple one.
Mm.
My own preference for software is what I call, you know, the application level software.
Yeah, or okay.
Actually, let me rephrase that. So application level software is software that people are using on a day-to-day basis, right? Mm-hmm. So there's direct interaction with the customer.
Microsoft Office, Google.
Yeah, so I actually do not prefer those because, in my view, those are easier to disrupt, exactly for whatever reason you're saying, like Zoom. My own preference is to buy software that's hidden, which I call like the middle layer softwares, right? Okay. So software that is working behind the scenes because that requires two levels of disruption. It requires disruption at the user level and it requires disruption at the developer level,
right?
Okay. Developers need to change and the users need to be unhappy, right? If the users are unhappy, developers are not going to change. And, you know, it's a really complex. Once you get into that thing, so database software like MongoDB, if developers are happy and the users of those products which the developers are developing are happy, it's really hard to get out. And those tend to be really sticky. The converse is that they're also harder to win. The battles actually continue for a long time.
Yeah,
but those are the companies that can deliver 30% growth for an infinitely long period of time, right?
And a moat at the same time, right? They're actually adding to that
yeah,
moat.
Yeah, it's incredibly sticky.
Yeah, yeah,
it's incredibly sticky. It's incredibly, you know, capital light in that sense. So those are the ones I like to own. The types of Zoom, I don't think I have. Like for the equivalent of Zoom, I like to own products which I call have customer fanatism. Like so stuff like say Apple, where people would line up.
Totally.
Or
Tesla, where people are sending $1,500 in advance of a car that might come in a few years' time.
Yeah, like,
that is amazing.
So, yeah, so those are things. But you know, like and where there is, I guess, product optionality or multiple things that is happening, right? Nice. So that gives you a little bit. Zoom doesn't fit that bill for me, here's the thing I'll say in favor of Zoom. If you generate that kind of cash, your balance sheet is going to have billions of dollars of cash.
Right, right.
You're throwing billions of dollars of cash.
Right, right.
You can take it like a death punch and come back to life.
Yeah, right. Okay.
So I'm a big fan of businesses that generate that kind of cash, that have cash on their balance sheet, that have like... You know, it is a phenomenal business, right? And that's why people are willing to pay phenomenal multiples because it's a phenomenal business. I mean, what you want to own, that or Commonwealth Bank? It's not a comparison at all, right? So I think that's the difference.
Very good. I'll stop giving you grief about Zoom now, mate. We've got time, I reckon, for maybe one, maybe even two mailbag questions. Let's see how we go, mate. The first one is my favorite one we've got so far. And it's a reminder to me that we often, I don't think this was tongue-in-cheek, this is a genuine question, and it reminds me that often we don't explain our terms as much as we should, or maybe just I don't explain mine as much as I should. Question from Lockie during the week, mate. G'day, Scott and Doc. What does it actually mean to stay foolish? Cheers, Lockie. He says, hashtag, get Doc in my DMs. DMs being direct messages, I assume, Lockie. Deeper meaningfuls, maybe, whatever you like, but I'm pretty sure it's direct messages. I love our hashtags, mate. There's a couple of good ones coming up too on Sunday, so stay tuned for those. A bit of fun. I like the question. I'm going to have a go at this, mate, but I want you to have a go first. What does it mean to stay foolish?
Oh, it means many, many different things. So, I mean, number one, I think is, think about business a little bit more holistically, right? I mean, don't think of them as tickers. Think of them that you own this business. And how would you approach something if you're an owner? If you're a small business owner, you would watch it. You would not really react to, you know, short-term issues. You'd be willing to, you know, ride out a volatile period. You would probably reinvest in the business. And if those sort of things are happening in a business that you have a partial share of, then, you know, you would just let it be. I think those are the things. And then, you know, so you spend responsibly, you save, you invest, you do that regularly over a period of time. You find the businesses you like to follow, you watch them, you know, you can study them over a period of time. So it's all of those, you know, you study, learn, and invest over a period of time, and you just keep this very long time frame in mind. And I think you've also acknowledged at the same time that there are multiple ways in which people can go about doing this. There's no one particular formula, method. You know, you find your way to run the race, and it's really not a race, it's a marathon. So, you know, you find your way to basically participate in the marathon and do good by yourself, I think.
I like that, mate. I got a couple of comments on what you said because I love that answer. I love the race marathon idea. To my mind, it's not even a marathon as much as it is a race with yourself. You know, trying to be the single best at anything is probably, it's a worthy goal, but letting others kind of dictate, you know, the risk that you throw good money after bad trying to chase somebody else who's making a couple of dollars more than you are this month or this quarter or this year can also be painful. So I would say absolutely, but, you know, race against yourself, be as good as you can without necessarily worrying about the envy component of investing, because that can really bring you unstuck. If you saw Afterpay and you missed it like I did, be tempted to throw money at the next big buy now, pay later, just in case it's the next Afterpay. It's probably a terrible idea. You're much better finding the next Afterpay in some other industry that's going to be, you know, the leader and the innovator rather than the pale imitation. So just be careful about that. But I love the marathon idea. I also love the idea of kind of being holistic about the investing. And I think, look, Lockie, you may not know, actually, mate, the phrase or the name, the Motley Fool, the name of our company, actually comes from Shakespeare. And it comes from a particular Shakespearean piece. As it turns out, the character of the Motley Fool is in a few different Shakespearean plays and dramas, comedies. But the Motley Fool was motley, i.e. multicolored, and fool in the language of the day was the court jester. So this was the multicolored court jester was the Motley Fool of the day. And he was the only person who could tell the king the truth without losing his head. And our business was born not out of an investment bank, not out of some shiny bum analysts in big high-rise buildings, but actually started by two English majors who, yes, had some relatives who were in the stock market. So got an education from their family, their father and uncle in particular. Tom and David Gardner started the business and with a mate of theirs, Eric Ridholm, basically to try and do things a bit differently. And David came up with the name of the company, The Motley Fool, to kind of just give that sense that we're not trying to copy everybody else. Often, they're not very often these days, mate, but in the olden days, we used to talk about the wires of Wall Street, capital W wires. And being a fool was being different. It was choosing not to accept the accepted wisdom, the so-called accepted wisdom or common sense of the day, but to really look again and find different ways of doing things. And certainly, Doc in particular, and following from David Gardner's lead, a very, very, very different investment style than you'll find on most of Wall Street or even in Australia. That's changing, by the way, because turns out these guys were right. And so, you know, some professional investors are finally catching on. But the idea of being foolish is just kind of being independent, taking a different view, saying the things that need to be said. I reckon I've probably ruled myself out of more potential jobs in the future than I have actually made myself available for them, because I don't mind taking a swing at some people in our industry who aren't doing the right thing. So it's just trying to do the right thing. Stand up for the individual little investor. Tell the truth regardless of the consequence. Speak truth to power. So that in a broad sense is what the company tries to stand for. And certainly, as Doc said, the sorts of ways we do that are trying to invest in a different way. We think a better way, a cleverer way. We call it foolish, capital F foolish rather than lowercase f foolish. To sort of talk about, you know, that's the way we do things as a company. We don't have a house view on any single company, by the way. But we have a reasonable house style or house approach, which is to be, as Doc said, be business focused, be long-term investors, try and think through the realities of the businesses themselves as part owners, rather than just looking at squiggles on a screen or moving share price and try and guess or day trade or somehow, you know, play silly buggers. We're trying to genuinely think like business owners and invest for the long term. And certainly for Doc, certainly for David Gardner and Tom Gardner, our long-term returns have come from exactly that sort of approach. Did I do that justice, mate?
I think it did.
Beautiful. One more? Can I sneak one more?
Oh. Well, I was thinking this is a good note to end this one.
You want me to wait till Sunday?
Yeah.
You're a hard man.
But, so like it's a special Sunday. It's not really that far away. I mean, you know, how much is the time between a Friday and a Sunday? Not that much.
You're a hard man. All right. Well, if Doc says it, it has to be true. That's it for this podcast. If you do want to hear your question answered or you have some feedback for us, like Lockie, you have a question, feel free to hit us up on all of our various socials and contact spots. If you already know this by heart, then awesome. If not, then listen along. And if you're sick of us saying it, our apologies. But, you know, it's a free podcast, so bear with us. If you want to hit us up, if you're on the emails, if that's your only foray into social media or communication, hit us up at info@fool.com.au, and our wonderful member services fools will make sure that gets straight to us. We have a Slack channel for our podcast questions. We'll answer some of those on Sunday. Would have been today, but Doc wouldn't let me. So if you have a problem with that, blame him, not me. If you want to jump on socials in the meantime, between now and Sunday, if you just can't wait, but you want to talk to Doc, at Anirban Mahanti is his Twitter handle. Mine is at TMFScottP. The Motley Fools is at The Motley Fool AU. If you want to go onto the Instagram, I'll use it next because it's easy. The Twitter handles are the same, at TMFScottP, at The Motley Fool AU. Nice and simple. Or on Facebook, our company page is The Motley Fool Australia, all one word. And I'm at Scott Phillips Money, again, all one word. So there you go. Other than that, you're going to have to wait until Sunday, not because I wanted to, because Doc said I had to. Sorry, mate, just throwing you under the bus there. In the meantime, don't forget, you can and should subscribe to the Triple M Motley Fool Money podcast through iTunes, your favorite Android podcast app, or go to Podcast One. And by the way, we did get some feedback during the week, Doc. Apparently, people missing the Sunday mailbag episodes through Apple Podcasts. Apparently, I'm told if you unsubscribe, delete the podcast, and resubscribe, it solves the problem. So I can't vouch for that. I don't have an Apple phone. I certainly haven't had that issue myself. But if you are and have, give that a go. Make sure you remember to resubscribe. Don't unsubscribe, then leave it there. That'd be bad. So make sure you do resubscribe. But do that on Apple iTunes on the podcast player. Of course, if you like what we're doing, please leave us a review, throw us some stars, and tell your friends. Skywriting, chalk writing, speech bubbles. Just even tell them. Grab their phone, open their podcast app, and do it for them. Subscribe to the Motley Fool Money podcast for them. Of course, if they are unhappy about that, blame you, not us, because, you know, you've got to exercise responsibility. But, you know, help them out. Subscribe them to the podcast so they can get a little bit of a foolish straight talk too. And, of course, speaking of that, you can get a dose of foolishness straight to your inbox and an offer to join Dividend Investor by going to fool.com.au/MMM. That's it for this week's Motley Fool Money. We'll be back on Sunday with another dose and a bumper dose of foolish insight. Fool on.
Fool on.
The Motley Fool and people appearing in this program may have positions in the companies mentioned. General advice only. Please speak to your financial professional to understand how it may pertain to your situation. Subscribe to the free newsletter at fool.com.au/MMM. The Motley Fool operates under Financial Services License 400691.